Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. How are you all doing?
Good.
I heard a story a couple of weeks ago about a father who described a conversation he had with his teenage daughter. They were sitting at home one evening when the girl received a text message from her mother which asked this question: "What do you want from life?" The girl was so taken aback by the depth of the question, she started just talking with her father about these deep, deep themes they'd never discussed before. Her hopes, her fears, her dreams, the things she really valued, the things she really believed in, her desire for a relationship where she could love and be loved, her desire for fulfillment, for meaning, for health, for wealth, for security. The father said it was the most profound conversation he had ever had with her, punctuated only by a second text message which said, "Sorry, autocorrect fail, what do you want from Lidl?" It's one of the deepest and most profound questions we can ask ourselves. What is it we truly want from Lidl? Robert Waldinger, you can't get any of those things from Lidl, but there we go. Robert Waldinger, who is an American psychiatrist and the director of the longest running study into adult development at Harvard University. It's a 75-year study which tracked the lives of 724 men from the Boston area. Half of them were Harvard graduates, half of them for the poorer, more deprived part of the city. Every year since 1938, he and his predecessors have been asking these 724 men, and in fact all their wives and children, 2,000 children across the course of the study, various questions about life, about work, about their health. They consulted their medical records to try and draw together this comprehensive study to answer this question: what makes a good life? Now there are only 60 of those people remaining. They're in their 90s, and these men have had incredibly diverse experiences of life. Some of them became successful businessmen, others became drug addicts, one became a president of the United States, although I looked it up and I couldn't find out which one that was, but there we go. The whole study was designed to answer the question, what makes a good life? And Waldinger summarizes the results like this. He says, what are the lessons that come from the tens of thousands of pages of information we've generated on these lives? Well, the lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder and harder. The clearest message that we get from this 75-year study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. They discovered that the most important factor that determines someone's health and quality of life was the quality of their relationships. And the people who had strong relationships age 50 were the most fulfilled and satisfied aged 80. Those who were connected to friends and family tended to live longer, have healthier lives, sharper mental capacities, stronger memories as a result. Quite literally, they found that relationships preserve people's health while loneliness kills. This is not the only study to have concluded that. There is a lot of research which makes the same point. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago now, it was Mental Health Awareness Week. And this year, they decided to focus their campaign on the subject of relationships because, as they put it, good relationships help us live longer and happier lives with fewer physical and mental health problems. They are as vital as better established lifestyle factors such as eating well, exercising more, and stopping smoking. Strong relationships are vital for good health. Just the other week, scientists from Oxford University concluded that having lots of friends is a better painkiller than morphine. So next time you're there in a hospital bed, just gather lots of people around you, do away with the drugs. I think that's why the Beatles sang this lyric: "I get high with a little help from my friends." I'm sure that's what they were talking about. They were ahead of their time. Perfectly innocent remark. Aristotle put it like this: without friendships, no one would choose to live, even if they had all other good things in life. Relationships matter. They matter not just because they're fun, because they're enjoyable, but they matter for our health. And not just our physical health, our emotional health as well. And we are partway through a series which we have called The Heart of the Matter, in which we are thinking about how we can care for our inner lives, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions. And today I want to look at the question of friendships, of community, and to ask, how does deep community help us to live healthy, fulfilled lives? And what I want to do is look at that passage from Mark chapter 2, which we just heard read, and to consider how that works as a model for deep friendships. Just to recap, Jesus returns back to home in Capernaum. All these people hear about him. They've heard of all the healings and miracles he's done, and they flock to see him, so much so that the house is full and people are piling out onto the streets. Four friends bring a fifth guy who's been on this mat, paralyzed, presumably for many years. They bring him to Jesus, but they can't get close, and so they fight their way through the crowds. They get up on the roof. They lower him through the roof to the feet of Jesus, hoping that he will experience healing. And in this story, I think we see a powerful model of strong community. And so I want to invite us to put ourselves into this story, and I want to ask two simple questions this afternoon. The first is this. Whose mat are you carrying? Whose mat are you carrying? There is loads we don't know about this story. We don't know how long the guy's been in this situation. We don't know how long these people have been friends. But what we do see is that there are four people deeply committed to the well-being of their fifth friend. And they go to extraordinary lengths to get him to Jesus. I think the first thing to say about the power of community is this. True friends notice. They notice when there is need. We read this in the passage. When Jesus again entered Capernaum, the people heard that he had come home. They gathered in such large numbers that there was no room left, not even outside the door. People heard and they flocked there. Of course, they had no social media, no BBC news alerts. Like, it wasn't like, hey, everyone knows suddenly Jesus has returned home. Word of mouth would have been the deal. I don't get the impression that this guy on the mat regularly got out of the house. I doubt he had seen Jesus. I doubt he had heard. Maybe he'd heard stories about him, but you get the impression that probably what happens, well, these friends heard the stories about Jesus. They heard Jesus was back in town. Maybe they'd seen him for themselves, and they made a connection between this healer and their mate. You get the impression they took the initiative. They noticed a need, and they figured out a way of meeting that need. True friends notice needs. I can often find myself just getting so self-absorbed with my own problems that I don't notice the needs of others, let alone do anything about them. How about you? Are you the kind of person that notices the needs in the lives of others around you? If not, how can you carve out time and space in your life to notice more? It may well be that you need to simplify your diary to make more space for time where you can have deeper conversations than just superficial ones, where you can ask the questions and genuinely find out what is going on in people's lives. For me, I know that when I pray for my friends, I feel more invested in their lives and I tend to notice things more as a result. How are you doing at noticing the needs of the lives in the lives of those around you? Of course, though, noticing is only part of it. And the second thing is this, friends not only notice, they act, they do something about it. And what we see in this passage is quite radical. These guys, they get their mate on the mat, they carry him to where Jesus is. We don't know how far, they didn't have Uber, they couldn't just quickly just get, they had to carry him on a mat. They get there, there are huge crowds. I don't know how they got him like over the crowds. It's like, I imagine this kind of Glastonbury crowd surfing kind of thing, getting their mate to the front. They then get him up onto the roof. I said in the South Service, I have no idea how they get them up onto the roof. And then biblical scholar and New Testament archaeological expert Tim Frisbee said, idiot, they had steps out the side of the house. And so, oh, yeah, of course, that's how they got him. But still, they had to get through the crowds to get to the steps. They get him up onto the roof. They break through the roof, and then they somehow winch him down to Jesus' feet. Now, for those of you for whom vandalism is a major concern and, you know, your main objection to this passage right now, rest assured, this was not like irreparable damage. It's not like they took a wrecking ball to Jesus' house. Actually, the roofs were constructed with these wooden beams across which lay these reeds that were held together by mud. And so you could actually just break them apart quite easily. There'd be a bit of mud and a couple of broken reeds, but it's not like bulldozing Jesus' house down. This was not irreparable damage. I hope that helps you a little bit. But these people still took radical steps to get their friends to Jesus. I mean, I say it's not irreparable damage. Don't come and do that to my house. I would not like it. But these guys go to extreme lengths to get their friend to the feet of Jesus. I, looking at that situation, probably would have written it off from like the first moment. I would have been like, there are at least a dozen reasons why it's not worth my effort, why it wouldn't work. I mean, I've got to get him from there to there. Do you know how difficult it is to carry a guy on a mat? I've got to get him through the crowds. It's not going to happen. I've got to get him up the stairs. I mean, that's hard. An angle, he'll slip up. I don't know. Yeah, getting him up onto the roof. I've got to break through the roof. What if Jesus doesn't like that? I break through the roof. Like, how am I going to get him? I've got to lower him down. I've got to lower him down without dropping him. I would have written it off like ages ago. But these guys don't see the obstacles, or at least if they do, they see through the obstacles. They don't care about the obstacles. They are so deeply committed to getting their friend to Jesus. They've seen a need, and they're going to do something about it. The psychologist, Yuri Bronfenbrenner, describes family as this: a group which possesses and implements an irrational commitment to the well-being of its members. I love that description, and I think it's a great description of what we see in this passage here, an irrational commitment. We don't usually think irrational is a positive word, do we? I don't like to tell people, I'm a deeply irrational person. No, but here, I think he uses... But here, he uses it in a positive way. Irrational commitment. What does he mean? Well, I think when we spot the needs in someone else's life, if we approach them rationally, what we tend to do is this. We tend to think, what's in it for me? Will this be worth my time, my effort, my energy? We tend to weigh up the pros and cons. And then, if you're anything like me, we use that data sort of to convince ourselves out of doing the bold thing. That's what happens when we make rational decisions. But when you look at someone's need and your first thought is not rational, it's not about me, but it's like, I don't care what it costs. I am getting that person out of that situation. That is a rational commitment to the well-being of others. That's exactly what we see in this passage. That's true community. So what's your reaction when you spot the needs in the lives of those around you? Do you look at it and think, well, there's not much I can do about it? Do you turn a blind eye to it, pretend you didn't notice? Do you say, well, I guess if I notice, others will notice, and if others notice, someone will deal with it? Do you weigh up the pros and cons and convince yourself it's not worth doing anything about? Or do you do the more spiritual thing where you say, I'll just, when I go home, I'll pray for them. I won't meet them. I'll just pray for them. Actually, James says some challenging things about that. He says this: what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed. I mean, that's undeniably a nice thing to say to someone, right? But does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. True community, true friendship, which brings the best out in the lives of others, notices needs, but doesn't just write them off or excuse them, but does something about it. And often, true community goes to extraordinary lengths to bring out the best in others. Now, obviously, we cannot all deal with every problem that we come across in everyone's lives. I'm not saying that we should all expect to have irrational commitment to the well-being of everyone we meet. I don't think that is possible. I don't even think it's sensible or appropriate, actually. But I do want to ask you this question. Are there any people in your life that you care about that much? Whose mat are you carrying? It may well be only a small community, but there ought to be people in every one of our lives who we would give up anything to get out of a difficult situation, to bring to the feet of Jesus. Whose mat are you carrying? Who have you let know you are there for them, whatever it takes, whatever it costs? Whose mat are you carrying? True friends notice, and true friends act. They do something about it. I remember when I went to university, I started attending a church not dissimilar to this in many ways, although very different to anything I'd experienced before. And I was invited to a midweek group, which met way off campus on the other side of town in the pastor's house. And I was told that, because the university campus was nowhere near this guy's house, what they did was they just invited students to gather at this particular place on campus, and cars would come past at 7 p.m. on a Wednesday, whenever it was, and just pick up all the people, and off we would go, and we'd meet in this guy's house. So I arrived, and I didn't know anyone that was going to this group, so I kind of got there, and there were loads of people around, and I didn't know who was waiting for the cars and who was just there. I'm not sure. But as I looked around, I noticed that some people were holding like tin cans, like vegetables and custard and things that come in cans. And some people had like dried pasta and rice, and I didn't know what that was about. But the cars arrived, and these people that were clutching tins got into the cars. And I thought, oh, it must be like, you know, wear a red carnation. It's kind of carry a tin of beans. I don't know. And that was the symbol. I don't know. But they let me in the car anyway. So I got in the car with these tin carriers. And off we went to the other side of town. And we got to the other side of town. We arrived at the pastor's house. The door opened, and everyone started going in. And there was a box by the door. And people put the things in the box. I was like, man, this is really, they've got some toll booth system. And I don't have, I'm going to get to the front of the queue and they'll go, no beans, you're not coming in. And I just no idea what was going on. So I kind of got there and they didn't ask me for anything. So I just went in and fine, I got away without paying the tax. It was great. So we went in, we had a good evening and no one mentioned it at any point. So on the way back, I said to this guy, hey, what was the deal with that, you know, paying with vegetables to get into the pastor's house? What's that thing? And he said, no, that's not what was going on at all. And he explained that 2 weeks before, a guy in the church, an older guy, had lost his job. And his wife was already a stay-at-home mum. They had 2 or 3 children. And they were really struggling to feed their family as a result. And some of these students had noticed and thought, well, we don't really know these guys particularly well, but we'd love to do something to meet this need. And so they decided something very simple and basic they could do is every week just collect some things to make a food parcel to go towards feeding their family that week. And that made a huge impact on me as a student, as someone who was just getting used to this new kind of community. I mean, it's not the biggest, glitziest, roof-tearing story I could tell you. I could tell you far more bold and sort of big stories, but I tell you this one because it made a huge difference on me. It was perhaps the first time that I can remember, at least, that I ever saw community in action like this, where people who didn't actually even know this family said, I see a need, I'm going to do something about it. And it made a huge difference for me at a time where I was considering whether I even wanted to be in church. I'd grown up going to church and kind of resenting it most of my life and thinking maybe university, this is perhaps my time to get away from church and go my own way. But actually seeing that, amongst other things, really made me think, I like this community. I want to be a part of community where people care for one another like this. It's a powerful thing. Whose mat are you carrying? Are you making space in your life to recognize the needs around you? And when you recognize them, are you doing something about it? Let's take another look at the story. I said I wanted to put us into the story. And if I were to ask you, where do you see yourself in the story, or where would you like to see yourself in the story? I'm sure many of us would say, yeah, I'd like to be thought of like the helpful guys, you know, the four carrying the mat, the strong, supportive types. And that's great. But I would also put it to you that at many times, we find ourselves playing the role of the person on the mat. Because we can't always be the strong ones. All of us have times when we have moments of weakness. All of us find ourselves being the person on the mat. So my second question is this. Who's carrying your mat? Who's carrying your mat? All of us, I think, have stuff inside us that we wish wasn't there and we dearly want to keep hidden from everyone else. We all have inner turmoil, conflict, things we have done that made us feel awful, things we feel bad about. Or we come across circumstances in our lives that don't go the way we had hoped they would, and they leave us feeling weak or vulnerable. Maybe it's relationship breakdown, health issues, study, work issues, sudden loss of a job, all sorts of things that make us feel vulnerable. My question is this. At those moments in your life, who's carrying your mat? Who do you allow to see you in your weakness and your vulnerability? We don't like to admit it, but all of us have a mat. Let me illustrate this a little bit. Can I have the next slide? There was an art project that took place at Brighton Station at the end of last year. I don't know how many people have heard of this, The Waiting Wall. Look it up if you haven't heard it. It's fascinating. These guys erected an enormous screen above the departures board on the concourse at Brighton Station. And what they did was they invited people to anonymously submit via text message or email or via the website their deepest confessions, the things they'd never told anyone, their fears and their concerns. They then got put up on this enormous board and broadcast to all the commuters for everyone to see. Now, I don't know about you. That's probably not what I want to do. I think, yeah, I want to let everyone who's traveling through Brighton Station know my deepest concerns, the things I've never told anyone. But they were staggered by the number of people that took them up on the opportunity. They said that in one 24-hour period alone, over 1,000 people submitted their confessions to be put up on this wall. Let's just look at a couple of the examples, thousands of them. I'm a bland and unattractive person. I've struggled to deal with my mediocrity. Next slide. I love my husband very much, but I have a secret longing to fall in love again with someone new. Next slide. I tell people I'm fine, but in reality, I'm depressed. Next. Sometimes I get so angry, I feel like I can lose control completely. Next. I'm afraid that I cannot make my family happy and proud of me. And we could go on and on. I'll put a few more examples up. People just confessing their inner turmoil, having it beamed out on this screen. The organizers said they found it fascinating. Some commuters would just stand there, just looking for ages. They would miss their train because they were so mesmerized by the messages on the screen. Others just couldn't bear to look at it. They would just look away, or they would leave the station and find another way of getting to work. Others would come to the station and stand there looking at the board. They didn't want to travel anywhere. They just wanted to see what was going on in the hearts of the people who lived around them. Others would see the board, be fascinated, get to work, then log on to the website and keep hitting refresh for hours just to watch the confessions of others. The organizers said this: some of the messages are so upsetting, we can't really take them in. There are a lot about regret, death, relationships, depression. Others are lighter. That's fine. We want people to use it any way they want. It seems there is a universal appeal and a need to share your problems. Now, what I find fascinating about the project is this. There is a universal need for us to share our problems. It taps into something that is deeply true of many, I would say all of us. And the weird thing is, we spend most of our lives pretending there is nothing wrong with us. We all have a mat. We all have stuff inside. And we put huge amounts of energy into letting no one see it, keeping it secret. Why? Because we think that if people knew those things about me, I would be judged, rejected, ridiculed. No one would trust me. No one would love me anymore. So we hide them. But the second we have an opportunity to get it up on a screen in an anonymous fashion, a way we will not be judged, we will not be ridiculed, people leap at the opportunity. Why? Because I think we know deep down that it does us good to get those things off our chest, to express them. Of course, we're not going to express them in a way that people know it's us. As soon as we can do it anonymously, we just put it up there because it makes us feel great. What if there was a better way? What if there was a way you could get that sense of trust, that lack of judgment, but not have it on an impersonal screen like this? True community should be able to provide that. I think the healthiest thing is to find yourself in a community where you can do just that, where you can allow people to see you in your weakness, on your mat. Because as fascinating as this project is, actually, I doubt it had any lasting effect in the lives of people who text in. Because it may make us feel great. It may give us a momentary sense of catharsis to be able to confess these things, but it doesn't lead to lasting change. Whereas if you are able to find people with whom you can be vulnerable and honest and allow them into your lives to help you, that can lead to incredible change, incredible healing as a result. So here's my question. Who do you allow to see you on your mat, as it were? Who do you allow close enough to see you in your weakest moments? Who do you trust enough to confess to them and allow them to help you? If we want to live emotionally healthy lives, here are two suggestions. I think we need to firstly seek deep community. Seek deep community. And deep community doesn't just happen. We don't just kind of drift into it. It takes effort. It takes work. Who are the people that you would call at 4 a.m. if your world fell apart? Who are the people that you would trust enough to confess to, knowing that they will not judge you or break your confidence? Who are the people that you would call to come and intervene when you are just stuck in this ongoing row with your spouse that you can't get through and you just need help? Chances are it's not going to be people you met at this service last week and shared one beer with. That's not how it's going to work. Deep community, the kind of people you can trust, are going to be the kind of people you've got to know over time, over weeks, over months, over years. The people who know you so well and who have allowed you to get to know them. The people you've laughed with, cried with, joked with, rowed with, broken up with, made up with. Again, the people you've been real with. That's where deep community is going to be of most benefit to you. How do you find deep community? Well, it may be that it starts by being part of community here. Sundays are great. Midweeks are better. we have all sorts of opportunities where we can gather together in smaller groups and really get to know people. We run groups called Connect Groups. There are many right across the city, some particularly associated with the service. You might find them to be great places to start building deep community. And don't worry, we're not expecting you just to turn up and bare your soul to everyone. That wouldn't be fun for anyone. I don't want that. But actually, what may help is going along to one of these groups and starting to get to know a few people with whom you can build deep friendships that will have a lasting impact in your lives. Seek deep community. Here's something that I did actually while I was preparing this talk, which you may find helpful, a little bit of homework for you. When you get home, get a bit of paper and draw a picture of a mat on it. That's a mat. It's clearly just a rectangle. No prizes for making the most beautiful mat, but there we go, it's symbolic. Draw a mat, and on the mat, write down various areas of your life. Maybe your relationships, your parenting, if appropriate, marriage, study, work, whatever it happens to be. Write down your character flaws. You may need a bigger mat than I did, that's fine. But just write down... you almost certainly will. Just write down... all the areas of your lives on the mat itself. And then round the outside of the mat, write down the list of friends who you allow to see you in your vulnerable state, in all your honesty. I'm not looking for like a full inventory of your Facebook friends here. I'm just like, just the people who you really trust and who you allow in. And these guys in the story, they had five. You know, five people, four friends. It may be that you just start with four people. Five people, six people, maybe a couple of couples, who knows? But the people who you allow to see you as you really are, the people you go to for help. And then take a look at the stuff on the mat and see, is everything here covered? Are there people around the outside that I could honestly talk to? Now, it may well be that you wouldn't talk to everyone about everything. As I did this, I looked and I thought, yeah, there are a couple of people I could talk to about anything in my life. I know that would be fine. I know my wife and I could talk to those people. I would talk to those people by myself. There are some people I thought, yeah, I would talk to that person about this area of my life, but probably not others. That's fine. Have a diverse group of people. But make sure that every area of your life is covered. And if you find that there are areas of your life you just couldn't talk to anyone about, then maybe two things. Maybe you need to build some deeper relationships with people who can really help you in that area. Or it may well be that there are names who are already around the outside of their mat who could be the people you could talk to. You've just never initiated that kind of conversation with them. Why not do that? Because actually having names on a bit of paper is only half the problem. We actually have to be honest with them. So my second tip is this: don't just seek deep community, but practice honesty with those people. A little while ago, I went for a drink with a friend, and we were talking, and it turned out that we struggled with some similar sorts of things, or we had done, and we had a lot in common, actually, as we were talking. And this guy was really honest with me and told me about all the struggles he had had and how he got into difficult situations and how he was dealing with it and the things that had really helped him. And I kind of nodded and sort of reciprocated and go, yeah, me too, and all that sort of stuff. I felt like it was a good, honest conversation. I got to the end of the evening feeling like that was great. I was really good to talk about these issues with this guy. I then got home, and over the next couple of days, as I reflected on it, I realized that I hadn't actually been as honest with him as he had been with me. And he had told me all these things that he had struggled with and how he had dealt with them. And I sort of nodded and said the right sort of things. But I realized that I sort of talked about my own issues as if they were past, they're dealt with, they're done. And I'd sort of not been as honest with him as I could have been. And so next time we met up for a drink, I said to him, I really valued our conversation last time, but I feel like I need to just admit that I held back a little bit and I might have misled you and I gave you the impression that these things are done and dusted and I don't need help. Actually, I do need help. Can you help me? I found that second conversation way more empowering than the first one because I stopped being dishonest with myself and I stopped being dishonest with others. Don't just seek deep community. Invest in that community. Deep friendships will only help us to the extent that we invest honestly in them. Take the guy in Mark 2. Imagine if his four friends came to him and said, hey, you know, is everything all right? I've noticed you're, you know, spending a lot of time on the mat these days. And he'd be like, oh, it's fine. No, this old thing, no, I could get off it any time I wanted. You know, he would still be there 2,000, actually, he wouldn't, he'd be dead. But you get my point. Like, denial doesn't help anyone. The first step to this guy experiencing healing was to be honest with himself and honest with his friends. Seek deep community and practice honesty with them. Deep friendships will only help us to the extent that we invest honestly in them. So are there areas in your life where you know you need help, but are perhaps too afraid to ask? How do you know that simply being honest with someone might not be the first step to experiencing healing? The philosopher and author Alain de Botton has written quite extensively about the failures of atheism and the value of religion whilst remaining himself an atheist. And he writes that forms of atheism or secular humanism or religion for that matter that declare that mankind is fundamentally good and that there is no problem that needs solving, no issue that needs addressing, those kind of ways of thinking actually don't help us at all. They lie to us. They keep us in denial. What's required is honesty about the human condition and about our weakness. And although he ultimately rejects many of the ideas at the heart of Christianity, he says there is much to be said for the Christian perspective that we are at heart desperate, fragile, vulnerable, sinful creatures, a good deal less wise than we are knowledgeable, always on the verge of anxiety, tortured by our relationships, terrified of death, and most of all, in need of God. And this, I think, brings us to the focus of the passage. Because in Mark 2, this guy didn't get better simply because he had some friends or just because he had good conversations with his friends. He got better because of what his friends did. They brought him to God. They brought him to the healer. The friends lower the mat into the house where Jesus is standing. And there's this moment like, what's going to happen? No guarantee that Jesus is going to do it. I mean, if I was Jesus, I would have been like, seriously, you just broke my roof and you expect me to fix your friend? Like, what do you want? That's not how this thing works. But Jesus has far more compassion than I do, thankfully. And he looks at the guy and he says, son, your sins are forgiven. Not even stranger, your sins are. He says, son, your sins are forgiven. All that internal stuff. The things you've done that hurt others, the attitudes you hold that are dishonoring to others, to God, maybe even to yourself, the secrets in your heart you daren't confess to anyone, the things you're ashamed of, they're all forgiven, they're dealt with, they're washed away. And Jesus approaches this guy with such tenderness. And the religious folk, the guys who are listening in, they get uptight at this point and they say, why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? But of course, that's exactly what Jesus is claiming. He is claiming to be God who noticed a need and decided to do something about it and stepped into this pain-filled world, taking on flesh so that he could come and meet us as our healer. He saw a need, and in psychological speak, he implemented an irrational commitment to our well-being. Or as John puts it, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. God stepped into this world to meet us in our moment of need. And here, Jesus claims to be able to deal with the fundamental problem that this man and all of mankind is facing. And we know from the rest of the story that the way he ultimately deals with the problems in our hearts and in this world is by taking them upon himself. He takes our brokenness, our mat, as it were, upon himself at the cross. But right now, in order to prove his credentials and demonstrate his power, Jesus physically heals this guy. He says, I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So he said to the man, I tell you, get up, take your mat and go home. He got up, he took his mat, and he walked out in full view of them all. Jesus heals this guy from his physical ailment. And in essence, he's saying this, look, if I am able to do that, if I am able to physically heal this guy, don't you think I'm also able to deal with the stuff in his heart as well? This passage raises loads of questions, tons of questions, but at the very least, it tells us this. God sees the things we keep hidden in our hearts, and he cares enough about us, and he is powerful to be able to make us whole, not only on the outside, but in the inside too. And we're told this amazed everyone, and they praised God, saying, we've never seen anything like this. Whatever is going on in your life, whatever you feel like you work hard to keep hidden, whatever your mat is right now, bring it to the healer. Bring it to the one who has the power to make you whole inside and out. And actually, what I find fascinating about this passage, just as we come into land, is this. Although Jesus says, I do this in order to show you that the Son of Man has the authority to forgive sins, it wasn't actually a kind of showing off thing that motivated Jesus. Here's the thing that I think motivated Jesus to perform this miracle. Verse 5, when Jesus saw their faith, Jesus responded to something he saw. And it's not clear, actually, if he means the faith of all five of them or whether it was the faith of the four friends and the guy on the mat had no faith at all. It could legitimately be either. But either way, I think we see this mysterious and beautiful interplay between the actions of the friends and the actions of the healer. God loves it when we demonstrate vulnerability, a deep commitment to community and faith, and somehow it seems to create the perfect atmosphere for him to act. True life-giving community is a place where we can be vulnerable and allow people to see us in our weakness without fear of judgment, where we can notice the needs of others and act with an irrational commitment to their well-being, and where others can do the same for us. True community is a place where you can share your needs, knowing that people are committed to bringing you to the healer, the one who can make you whole inside and out. That's the kind of community I want to be part of. That's the kind of community I want to be part of building here in London. That's the kind of community we're dreaming of this place to be. Isn't that the kind of place you want to be as well? Whose mat are you carrying? Who's carrying your mat? And are we bringing one another to the healer? See, I wonder if the band can come back up. It may well be that this week you feel like you need to figure out how to make space in your life to be able to better notice the needs and the lives of people around you. It may well be that you need to ask some honest questions of friends, or you need to ask questions, you need to invite people to ask honest questions of you. It may well be that you need to draw a bit of a mat on a bit of paper and have an inventory. Think, are there people who I'm allowing to see me in my weak state? It may well be that there are people you've never been honest with and you need to have some good conversations this week. The goal is that we bring one another to the feet of Jesus who can make us whole. And we're going to worship in just a moment. And this is really an opportunity to do just that. It may well be that you're exploring faith and this whole idea of God stepping into the world. Maybe it seems a baffling idea. Actually, maybe it seems a beautiful idea to you, but you just want to know more. Why don't you ask a friend today, help me to understand this Jesus. Bring me to his feet, as it were. And as we worship, we're going to sing songs that express our need for God and our trust in him. And this is a chance for us just to say, God, there are areas of my life where I feel weak and vulnerable. I bring them to you. Would you fill me afresh with your strength? And we'll have a prayer team who'll be available to pray as we worship. And if you would like prayer for anything at all, do come forward. They would love to pray with you and bring you to the one who can make you whole. Let's stand and let's worship together.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.